It's been a while, but I would like to call this meeting of the PAC today on May 8th to order, starting a couple minutes behind, but we definitely now have a quorum, so I'd like to do that. First thing I'd like to do on our agenda this afternoon is to submit the minutes for approval, and before anybody motions or seconds that, I think Pam has a slight minor change to mention. Pam?
Right. Just wanted to let you all know we did catch a revision at the last minute. Apologies to Elizabeth Clary, but she did send me an email, so she was considered excused for last meeting. I went ahead and made that change. The revised minutes will be up on the web, but we didn't print them for you over that slight change, but just want to let you know.
With that exception,
it's been moved and seconded to accept the minutes with that slight revision. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions. All right. Next on our agenda, then, is our subcommittee reports. And, Naomi, I think you're going to be giving the subcommittee report to start with. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. The Equity Access Committee met just a little bit ago. Actually, we met in the ABAG offices, which was a little different for us. And we had a nice chance to check in with each other because most of our members were there. Our main item was the FTA Section 5310 fiscal year 12, because that's the year of funding that we are analyzing, even though it's 2013 now, draft regional rankings. And so we heard some background on the 5310, which is a federal source of funding for capital for accessible transportation, primarily vehicles, but also sometimes dispatching software, radios, wheelchair tie-downs, that sort of thing. And it's primarily utilized by nonprofits and sometimes rarely transit agencies. So we just went through a 5310 cycle, and Drennan gave us the update on the upcoming schedule and then the list of the actual projects and where they scored and ranked so far. And so that list is available in our packet, which is on the web, or you can borrow any of ours if you're curious. And that went to the Programming and Allocations Committee this morning, and then it will go forward for further approval and then eventually go to Caltrans, and they'll finalize their process, and people will find out whether they're going to get their projects or not. And I believe that, we also, this is kind of important, discussed some of the challenges around the process. The application is very unwieldy for many organizations to apply with. We know that the 5310 process is going to change with the most recent transportation authorization, because it's going to incorporate what has been 5317 or New Freedom funding, which is very different, as it can be used for operations as opposed to capital. So our committee offered, and we wanted to let you know that we offered our assistance as Caltrans is revising this application and considering, for instance, how often they do the cycle. Currently, they are considering only doing it every 2 years instead of every year, and that could be a rather large hardship for a number of nonprofits. So, as I said, the subcommittee is putting forward an offer to provide assistance in that process, and we want to let you know that as well. Okay. Anything else from the subcommittee? Okay. Thank you.
Excellent report.
All right. Seeing no other comments on that subcommittee report, then our bulk of our business today is going to be on the draft Plan Bay Area discussion. We don't have Ken Kirky with us, but we do have Carolyn Clevenger with us. And Doug. So we... this committee heard the report last month and had a lot of opportunity, I think, to mull over some of the different aspects of it. And today, do you expect us to have a report today, or are we just going to primarily be giving you kind of our feedback and comments?
I think the goal of today is to be here. Doug and I are here for questions, but to mainly have you guys discussing what you'd want you know, your official comments back to the commission to be, I can give you just a sort of overview of the schedule to give you a sense of.
I think just to kind of kick us off and get us started. Thank you.
Great. So we are currently in the public comment period still on the draft plan and the environmental impact report. That goes through May 16th at 4 p.m. We do have an item going to the planning, joint planning and MTC, sorry, and ABAG administrative committees this Friday that looks at requests we've had to extend that public comment period. Staff's recommendation is not to extend that because of considerations, impacts it would have on the RENA schedule for ABAG and for the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Program at MTC. But we do expect probably a robust discussion with our commissioners and the ABAG board on Friday about that. If the schedule stays as is with May 16th as the close date, then the June meeting of our joint ABAG admin and MTC planning committee will be when we really start talking about the policy debate coming out of, you know, what we've heard during the comment period and all the different venues, as well as the results from the EIR, and, you know, what policies we might be considering as boards in terms of the final plan. So I think that one of the goals is for you guys to be able to talk about today what your, you know, initial comments to the commission will be at that, hopefully at that meeting for the Friday, June 14th board meeting. And then also, you know, we would be here again in June to help go over with you some of the initial staff recommendations in terms of potential policies and changes that would, you know, give you additional time in June to talk about what refinements you might want to take to your positions or additional questions you might have for us as we start you know, mulling over the final recommendations.
Okay, great. So rather than do a complete brain drain on page by page, I think having some type of a structure to have this discussion in would be advantageous. And Rich, you had your hand up first.
When it becomes time, and you tell me that.
Okay.
I just want to make a couple of comments I made at two of the Plan Bay Area meetings.
Great.
And that's all I'm really going to deal with. I'm not going to get into the policy, deeply into the policy stuff.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Then, Agon, do you want to kick this off?
Well, I was just reflecting kind of how we could have this conversation in an organized way, and maybe one option, Rich, to what you're saying is if people want a few general comments and kind of reactions about the plan, we could spend a few minutes on that. And then I was thinking that we could go through, in my view, kind of what three categories are, and this is sort of the question we can get back to you all. One is the question of sort of the land use alternatives and, you know, concepts that are in the plan, the different EIR alternatives, how concentrated or not, the distribution between central cities, and there's different visions there. We could have a discussion and some questions around that, the implications. I think then a second category would be the kind of transportation investment categories and programs. What do we think of those, more or less of any of them? That's probably, I think, Carolyn, correct me if you're wrong, the place where we could give our thoughts on one of our favorite topics, hot lanes. Sort of in that, but that's in the investment category. And then maybe the third category would be to talk about some of the specific policy tools that are tested in the EIR, the vehicle miles traveled fee, an additional dollar toll on the Bay Bridge, things like that. And then we could kind of, if there's any consensus around promoting or supporting one or more of those, we might want to do that. Question for Doug or Carolyn, by doing that, do we get at all the issues, or do you think that there's another category we're missing there?
I think the two other issues that were identified in the staff memo, just as areas that you all have had some robust discussions in the past, were both equity side pieces of it, which, you know, sort of can fall in those three, but might want to be called out separately, and then also the public participation, if there's anything you might want to say back in terms of how that's gone.
And I'll just add, in terms of, you know, that the actual plan document, it actually, that doesn't get to the last couple of chapters that really deal with kind of the advocacy and the work that we want to also be doing, you know, kind of over the next couple of years with some of our partners that are laid out in the plan. So just something to be aware of. If you think it's perfect, it would be good to get that feedback as well.
Okay. I was thinking maybe that could go in policy tools. You're talking about like redevelopment replacement and CEQA reform, but... So why don't we,
Yes, Kathleen.
One clarifying before we move in, but I like all of what that's going to touch on. And this question is for Doug or Carolyn. under the equity analysis, the different alternatives, there were going to be tables of what the alternatives resulted in distribution and performance on the targets. They were going to be posted online. I've been keeping an eye out for them, and I'm not seeing them. Are those going to be available before the comment window?
I'll check with Jennifer. She's been trying to get those out.
My comments are going to kind of be crafted based on part of that. So.
All right, so how about general comments, and then we'll move into some of these more specific categorical areas. So, Rich, do you want to start there?
Well, some of the comments that I made at the Plan Bay Area meetings, and I wanted to reiterate here, has more to do with the equity issues. It's not all I'm interested in, but it's the comments I made because many other people handled much of the other stuff that I was interested in saying. But first of all, I think we need more teeth in housing near transit. We need to support it better in the plan with legislation recommendations and actually trying to put some teeth in it with the local communities. And secondly, this plan is actually going to create a lot of wealth. There's going to be a lot of development in this area. And quite frankly, if we're not careful, outside forces will pull the money out of here and take it somewhere else. And I think we need some strong emphasis in there on a living wage like the airport and San Jose has all over the area, even if it's original, if it's possible to do a regional living wage. I don't know if that's legal. It may not be, since there's no government overlay that would probably allow that. But we need to at least pressure it. And the other thing is that I know I'm talking to my friends in the building trades that there's been a lot more developers from out of the area, Texas, the Valley, that are bringing people in for $12 or $15 an hour, keeping them in campers, some of them even on construction sites, housing them. And I think that there needs to be a strong emphasis on prevailing wage for these projects and PDAs, because we have to keep the wealth here so that people can afford to live here.
Lori?
And one of my comments was pretty much something I've always mentioned was public participation. I'm really very interested in knowing not only how Vallejo is going to really engage, or how we're going to engage our residents there, particularly our minorities, but neighboring communities. Because what one community does may be slightly different from what another community does, but if we're doing things that are too different, then it's not going to fit together anyway. So just ensuring that it's all kind of coordinated.
That's it. Any other overall comments? Randy?
I just have one general comment that, because things have come up, risen recently, that the concentration of our focus on PDAs means that in some respects at the local level, we lose track of the integration. We're really good at looking at the PDAs and how it integrates with transit, housing, and transportation. But meanwhile, we've kind of lost a tool to monitor how the rest of a city actually progresses. So I want to make sure that while we're concentrating on a PDA in a community and we're giving, you know, high fives on our accomplishments there, that we're not losing ground in other places in those communities or in the region simply because of our focus on PDAs.
Hang on.
I want to make maybe two comments here. One is about sort of the nature of this as a plan. And one is on the kind of nature of this as a vision. And I think just on the first piece and is that in many ways this is not a plan in the traditional sense. MTC has been in the business of doing regional transportation plans for many years, but just as sort of a reminder for us, the plan does not make changes to local land use decision, does not get down to that detail. And I think you're all acutely aware of that and acutely aware of how that's misunderstood in the local press. But it's just, in terms of the use of the word plan, it has elements of a plan, but it doesn't get down to one of the few tools that real land use planning is about, which is making those local regulatory changes. So I think that means that we have to recognize the limits of the plan. The second is about whether or not this is a vision for what the Bay Area should be. And I think there's a little bit of a tension here, and it's just important to acknowledge the PDA structure and framework is intended to be bottom-up and to get buy-in from local governments. It is seemingly a regional set of criteria, but they're reasonably weak. So it is not, by placing a lot of growth in PDAs, it is not placing growth in places objectively through some objective criteria are the best from some notion of a vision for the region. It is built around an element of consensus from local governments, although lots of local governments don't like that. So I think, to me, that's an important distinction because there's a lot of very great things about the plan. It expresses a region that we haven't been building for the last couple of decades, but it is not starting from the standpoint where it's saying this is where growth should be. It's starting from the standpoint of where growth could possibly go based on where some local governments might support it. The alternative three, I think, transit priority one or whatever, I forget the name of it, that one gets more at what a vision could be of a set of objective criteria. But to me, those, I don't know, that's useful for me a little bit to think about kind of the limits of the plan and what it's trying to do.
Thank you. Alan?
That's a great understanding, and the concern I have economically with all of this is we're going to push and incentivize the PDAs. And one of the problems is local governance hasn't caught up with what should be happening in those PDAs. And in those PDAs, in many cases, we're going to underdevelop those PDAs to what they should be for the long-term future. And by underdeveloping those PDAs, we're taking away the future to feed today at a much lower level than we should be feeding it. And I don't know the answer to this because of the balance of the local governance issues. I don't know how we incentivize or educate or do what we need to do to get the density we need in these areas to make them work as smart communities, or you're not supposed to call it that, but as good living, working communities. And the problem is if you go to some of these towns, they think three stories is a great living, working community. It isn't. Anyway.
Thank you, Alan. Marshall, did you have something? Lori.
I don't talk too much, but I do agree with Egon and this other gentleman over here, Alan. That is so true. I mean, this is so. I'd like to hear from MTC on this in terms of, or staff from this in terms of how you really do reach, you know, municipalities, the, you know, local governments to kind of figure this whole thing out, because I think that is a challenge when they're doing their general plans and updating their general plans and implementing or trying to implement specific plans or even adopt specific plans that are so out of character with what MTC is doing. How do you really bring that together? How do you really bring them on board? Because I see this happening so often in the many cities that I've worked in the Bay Area.
Thanks for the chance to respond. You know, I think a couple of thoughts that I might have. I mean, one is, you know, MTC in partnership with ABAG. So imagine, you know, ABAG sitting like maybe in an invisible chair right there, because this isn't MTC and ABAG's Policy Advisory Council. Or is there someone behind me from ABAG? But, you know, I think importantly, I would note that, you know, we've administered together with ABAG almost $15 million in planning grant funds directly to cities to do local land use planning and zoning changes alongside their general plans. So we actually see that as, I think, perhaps the best, you know, and most clearly demonstrable piece of work that we are trying to do with the cities that have PDAs and that are trying to set up this type of a land use framework for their own local jurisdictions. I think the other thing just to note, you know, when we set up the PDA framework about 6 years ago in partnership with ABAG, you know, the majority of PDAs that came in were actually identified as being planned priority development areas, right? There was a distinction between potential PDAs, those were places that thought maybe they'd like to be a priority development area in the future, and then places that actually had planning done, zoning in place to be a prairie development area, perhaps not necessarily hitting, you know, the highest marks across the board. But I think we were really struck by the fact that, you know, 60 cities wanted to participate, which is far more than we would have ever anticipated. And a majority of those PDAs that came in reflected the fact that cities, at least in some often very small part of their, you know, jurisdiction, had done some planning and zoning around this. So we still have plenty of work to do. We're going to continue that planning grant program to help fund cities doing that planning and zoning work where they are ready and willing and able to do so.
Randy. Thank you, Doug.
I think just kind of following up on this, it's not necessarily the planning and the zoning that's the issue. It's the implementation after the fact, because I'm personally experiencing one of those, and I believe it's MTC-funded planning processes, where the plan was X number of units of housing, X number of square feet of commercial retail. But when you get down to how it's actually going to be implemented, whoops, there was a whole bunch of acreage there that belongs to the water company that can't be used. So the actual ability to implement a plan is, I think, where all of us kind of hit our noses against the wall, because you can plan all you want, but if you don't have the realistic ability to implement that plan, how do we finesse that from this perspective?
I think that sort of a tease into some of the advocacy discussion that Doug was talking about, sort of towards the later part of the plan, where we talk about ongoing, you know, plan to build on chapter and advocacy, that those are probably areas where if this group can provide comment and feedback back to the commission on what they have out as the draft policies, that'd be helpful, because I think that's all about implementation. And I think that that's an area where we are trying to move the discussion onto, you know, how can we implement this and what are key policies or programs or legislative priorities that would address that.
And just the other thing I would add, and I think this is really hard to remember, is that this is a 28-year plan. So there are going to be big, important parcels or projects or investments that are going to be stuck for 27 years, and they could still be considered a success if they can come through in year 28 of the plan. So, you know, I mean, we need to think on the short term. I totally agree with Carolyn. We certainly have tried to write sections of the plan to be clear in that regards. But this is, I think to Egon's point, this is a longer term effort. You know, this is not like spot zoning for project approval, you know, this year. That's not what this plan does. It's not what we are, you know, equipped or allowed to do.
Great. If there aren't any other initial comments at the moment, what I'd like to do is ask Jane Kramer to come up and speak before us, and then we'll go into our different categories and start a little bit more conversation in depth. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. One's a comment and one's a thought. The comment is community is bandied around, and so far I haven't heard any effort for local communities and neighborhoods to tell you how they define community. And I think until you get some kind of a flexible policy that allows neighborhoods and local jurisdictions to do that, you are going to have a problem with implementation, because you don't know what to implement to begin with, let alone how. Well, maybe how. Technology is there, but that comes last. The other thought is something I think Alan brought up. Several people brought it up. Living wages. So if you don't want the money that's going to be generated by future development to leave, because big business interests control it and they take it elsewhere, maybe you want to give some thought to developing real local economies where the money does stay here, because it can't be used for venture capital. It can only be used for household needs and for putting into local businesses by local people. And how you do that is going to be up to local communities and policymakers to capitalize on that. But that allows the community to own the basic interest in the economic system, and along with that, of course, goes a local banking system. That's just a comment, a thought.
Thank you very much, Jane. All right, now if you look on page, I think it's 3.1-8, at least that's what it looks like here, we could start then with the land use policies. There's some major categories under that particular issue, including zoning, growth boundaries, fees and subsidies, and on the next page, the incentives for those. I'm thinking if we want to talk about land use and those policies, we can kind of gear our comments around here. If it's something that doesn't fit in this matrix, you could certainly gear it, state it at any time. So I'm going to get ready to take some notes here. But in terms of land use and policies, who would like to? And thank you for joining us at the table. So in terms of comments on the plan here with land use, so I've got Kathleen and then Benna. And just wave your hand, I'll put you on the list. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I don't have the full document in front of me, but I was just going to reference some of the impacts that are in the EIR summary of impacts. And under under 2.5 and looking at the sea level, it's significant but unavoidable. But one of the impacts under there is looking at areas subject to inundation and looking at pushing forward climate adaptation plans. And the only suggested change I would make to that mitigation is really partnering with local and regional public health and state public health on defining medically vulnerable communities and working with CalADAPT and working with public health at both the state and local level in those vulnerability assessments. And then under, I think it was 2.14, looking at due to population growth, the increased need for and use of facilities, schools, emergency services, et cetera. I think that impact really gets at the idea of we can't just accommodate more growth. We need to accommodate more growth with a maintained quality of life. To me, the mitigations are sort of solutions offered under that. It just seems to cite, yes, there will be an increased demand for these services, and we're going to have increased depreciation on these assets. So I'd like to see something moving forward in the final plan that says how we're going to maybe identify new revenue sources for that. And then lastly, I'm sorry, I don't have it. I believe it's impact 2.2-5, although I'll get you a corrected number on that. But it's really looking at phasing in the affordable units after fleet turnover to ensure reduced exposure to particulate matter and other sources of roadway emissions. A concern of that from the equity perspective is if we're phasing out and holding off on producing affordable units until 2023, that really doesn't do a lot for equity. So I would really try to be strategic and nuanced in the phasing of those units, because we don't have to necessarily wait to produce those units. You can put them on a different place in the site. So I know this isn't a project-level EIR. It's a program-level EIR. But since we are going to identify policy solutions in the final, those are three things I really wanted to touch on based out of the EIR. Thanks.
Good. Okay. Benna?
So I think one of the central questions around land use alternatives is what we already started talking about, and it's this whole idea of PDA versus not PDA versus whatever it is idea. And you can see that in the alternatives, that they each take a slightly different look at growth options. And from the leadership group's perspective, the PDA framework is an important one, mainly because it has local buy-in. And to Randy, your point earlier, you know, we can plan all that we want, and at the end of the day, it comes down to implementation. And without strong partnerships from the local officials, local staff, local electeds, and the neighborhoods, you're really not going to implement plans. They're kind of more visionary and pie in the sky. So I think starting with the PDA approach is absolutely important. But I would also say it's important to couple that with incentives for jurisdictions to nominate themselves as PDAs. So I think the One Bay Area grant was a great step in that direction. And you're already seeing some traction that's happening at the local level where cities are saying, oh, gosh, I really want to participate in that financial program, but have to figure out where our appropriate PDAs in our community in order to qualify. So I think with that two-step approach, we would get very far. So I'm fine with using the PDA model for now with those incentives. Thanks.
Thanks, Benna. Lori?
And then under the this classification, I'm just thinking of affordability, PDA and affordability for the surrounding municipality. I mean, because when you think about PDAs, it's usually, you know, in where low income resides. They can no longer either reside there or they have to kind of move away. So it's, it means gentrification for some income levels. And how do you really deal with that? And how should we address it in this document?
Something we want to talk about specifically under equity also then. Okay, Carlos?
Yeah, I don't know if my comment is in this land use or possibly in the equity section. Just I'm hearing the comments here and I'm thinking just how these infrastructure improvements tend to lead to you know, increases in land value, which tend to lead to displacement, and I'm thinking whether this is the time to talk about. I don't know how we would include it, but discussing the possibility of maybe at a, I don't know if usually it's at a local level, but I don't know if it could be done at a regional level, is looking at how cities can try and recapture some of that value, the added value of just putting in the infrastructure that tends to, you're hearing about it. I'm seeing a lot now down the extension of Fremont down to San Jose. You're seeing a lot of these opportunities starting to pop up near the stations. You know, it's how that could be thought about from a policy standpoint, capturing some of that at the local level, so that there can be affordable housing in the early years, and that also it can take care of some of these other mitigation issues that may come up, like displacement of businesses or you know, accommodating for growth of the local community there. So I just want to throw that out there.
Linda?
I just want to make a comment about the urban growth boundaries. That some cities were so set on how they did it that they made it almost impossible to change them. And in some cases, we might have to do that. And so I think we need to figure out a way that they can save face and do that. Like, for instance, the one in Livermore has to have the approval of the voters in order to be able to do it. We've got a problem right there. So.
I'm afraid I haven't seen this anywhere. And as we talk about these equity issues, and I always go back to Washington and Arlington, where they use benefit-based zoning. And they got public benefits, low-income housing, workforce housing, public parks, all those things, areas for a workforce to live, by trading off better zoning for those benefits. And that benefit-based zoning is a very powerful tool if you can get communities to use it. You can get billions of dollars of public benefits, and you can get a lot of things front-ended by giving a developer a couple more stories or more developable area, or perhaps form-based coding rather than what he would be used to in the local community. And basically, as long as the community buys into that area as a development area, it's a way to bring a lot of money to the table and solve some of these issues.
Through the chair, can I ask him a question?
Certainly.
My question for you is, when you say benefit-based zoning, are you talking about air rights?
I'm talking about air rights, and I'm talking about density.
Okay, yeah.
Air rights and density, and I think they got $1.5 billion in Arlington over just a period of 5 years in benefits-based zoning. So they had firehouses built. They had parks built. But this is the way to if the communities that are looking at this could see the benefits to the community, it's a way to solve a lot of problems.
Rich, and then Agon.
I really like what Alan's saying. To give you just a brief example of what can happen, in redevelopment in San Jose, our building was the first built in redevelopment, and we have 12 stories of below market rate senior housing above the office. And I'm not going to say which city right now, but they're because I don't want to alert anybody actually that might be saying no to this. But I've been going to some of their meetings, and they're proposing a change from about 38 feet of height on one of the downtown streets to 75 feet, which is where one of our offices set, with a vacant lot next to it. Great below market rate housing opportunity.
You support it?
I support it.
All right. Agon?
So I wanted to make two comments. I think, Benna, you addressed, and a couple of us addressed the question of PDAs, and I was interested to see if people had a strong reaction to the kind of the outcome of the more PDA-focused growth strategy versus the TPP-focused growth strategy, which leads a little bit to a question, if I can just ask this directly. Do you believe that the EIR results are clear enough to really distinguish the environmental performance of a growth that's more focused in the TPPs versus growth that's more focused in the PDAs? And then I have a second point about land use.
The differences between, and that was alternative two, the proposed plan, and alternative three, the transit priority, were not, you know, huge. The alternative three, the one that's focused around TPPs, did do the best in the transportation analysis. It had the lowest amount of travel at congested VMT. It reduced VMT more than the proposed plan. So there were some benefits there. I think that the differences, though, were not astronomical between the alternatives, but it is a different approach for how you get there, right? Sort of to Bina's point that the PDAs are more locally driven, and there's, you know, at least some amount of consensus behind those as they came in, whereas the TPPs, I think if you know, go through their summit, a lot of it overlaps with PDAs, but there's, you know, roughly, I can't remember if it's 25% or 30% that don't overlap, and I think those are areas where you have to question, you know, is that growth likely to happen given local considerations?
So maybe if I could convert this into a comment, and if people have some consensus around that, that the PDA framework is a strong one because it's more connected to local priorities, but and this is maybe a comment more back to ABAG directly, but it there's an opportunity with the next plan to reconsider the criteria for PDA, to double check that all PDAs actually have the level of transit service that they said they had when they applied for it, a question I've asked at ABAG Regional Planning Committee meetings a couple times, and to maybe raise the bar a little bit or have a sort of tiering criteria when it comes to investing money in the future, recognizing that the performance across the PDAs isn't the same. So that's sort of a comment. I don't know if others want to agree or disagree to that. And if so, we can go. And I have one final land use thing, but Ben, if you want to.
Sorry.
I was going to go to Kathleen first. Kathleen and then Ben.
I would just agree with a lot of what Agon was saying in terms of really looking at the performance of the PDAs. And I know Ann Flemmer has mentioned that when the CMAs come back and report on the performance of their PDA growth and investment strategy, that we'll take a look at it. But I just, I'm not ready to create a motion or something, but I think this group could speak to really strengthening OBAG and the PDA growth and investment strategies as a point for advancing some of those land use priorities, but also then looking at how potentially watered down the definitions of PDAs are becoming by the local definition of proximate access to.
Oh, this is a really interesting conversation. Aegon, if you're going to open up the envelope and ask for things for the next round, I would also add employment densities and employment centers as part of the PDA framework. There's a lot of places in Silicon Valley where there's a high concentration of jobs and sometimes good transit, sometimes not so great transit, but still a huge opportunity to direct some investments. In terms of the other question, so I am participating in VTA's PDA growth strategy and investment group, task group. And it's been a very interesting conversation for me because part of the membership of that group includes city planners. And so they come at it with a different perspective. And they cautioned me at our last meeting that it takes a lot for cities to step up voluntarily to nominate themselves as a PDA. And certain elected officials are putting themselves out there. And we should really make sure that the cities that are voluntarily stepping forward are rewarded in some way, shape, or form. So the question about raising the bar, yes, I think eventually, but maybe it's just a comment that at the end of the day, if you voluntarily say yes, you want to do something, there should be some sort of benefit. Maybe you don't get as much as another city that has, you know, hits the criteria better than you do, but some sort of benefit to stepping forward.
Yes, Randy.
And I don't want to keep harping back on one of my previous comments, but existing deficiencies aren't being addressed by PDAs. So somewhere along the line, we have to acknowledge that. And I remember reading the report about transit availability in San Francisco as related to low-income and minority neighborhoods and where those neighborhoods were concentrated, their transit availability was significantly lower. So I want to make sure that we are somehow also going forward with this, incentivizing people to address existing deficiencies. That it may not be within the PDA's structure or framework, but we should be looking at not just creating these islands of really cool, good stuff, while at the same time ignoring our kind of more desolate areas in terms of infrastructure. So that would just be my cautionary comment.
Okay, thank you. Aegon.
And then the last point I wanted to make about the land use policies was this fee on high VMT area that was tested in, I think, Alternative 3, which is, I think, quite intriguing. Curious if others on the council had thoughts or questions about it. Maybe a question sort of to staff here. If you could articulate what you've learned from the analysis of that in the EIR, and where do you see that going forward before we kind of give our comments on it?
In terms of what we saw for Alternative 3 was, at least what the analysis showed, that if you, and this is not really surprising, if you put a fee on growth in certain areas that are forecast to generate high VMT, then less growth will occur in those areas and more will grow in areas where you don't have that fee. I think that you do see that in Alternative 3 where you got more growth in the areas that did not include a fee compared to some of the other alternatives. But a lot of the vast majority of the growth was still in the same places, and because our growth in our region is such a small portion of our overall population numbers, we're a pretty well-established region, it did have some impact, but it was it was a pretty crude tool to apply across the models for all of the different alternatives. And I think when we look at the policies we tested, the next question would have to be feasibility and how you'd actually implement something. And I think there's a lot of questions about how we could feasibly implement that type of a fee.
I don't know if there's other comments on it, but I was going to say that I think it's a very interesting one, and it seems to look quite similar to some authority that the Air District has to explore a related fee. And so, the suggestion I would make is that it's an interesting enough proposal that might be difficult to implement, but certainly worth considering and trying to flesh out what it would look like. Is it the same as the indirect source rule that the authority and the legal backing exists for the Air District to do, and they've done it in other counties in California? What's the right level, where it could be implemented, and just so people understand the context, the Air District had a couple years ago planned to look into this, and then they made a decision to go change around CEQA rules and got into a little bit of political hot water as a result of that, and then decided, my understanding, not to look into this indirect source rule for the time being. But it's a very interesting and intriguing idea, and in the regional planning realm, we don't have a lot of policy tools to shape land use, so I think that this is certainly one that if others agree, I would like for the Policy Advisory Council to support the commission and ABAG at the very least to continue exploring it and to try to see how it could be incorporated into a future plan.
Okay, so it sounds like I'm sorry, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank everybody for their comments on land use on behalf of ABAC. I'm glad that I ventured into the room and happened to be invited up here. These are things that I'm going to take back to everybody at ABAC, and I think they're really beneficial comments that we'll consider.
Great, thank you. Now that we've discussed land use, and it doesn't mean you're precluded from discussing that again later because something may pop up or it may jar something in your memory, so certainly feel free to add a point later. But let us go focus now on the transportation side of this plan. Under that, on page 3.1-9, we've got a road network category, transit network, and then, of course, our climate initiatives. And then some of those tools, road pricing and parking policies also. So I don't know if it's the feeling of the committee to go right through these areas one by one, or if you'd like to give your comments on what you found in the plan to be something you want to highlight today. But either one, my list is empty at the moment. Okay, I got Rich and then Kathleen. Okay, Rich, thank you.
Yeah, I just a brief comment about CEQA streamlining. I know there's a lot of nervousness among activists like myself about streamlining CEQA, but there was a recent article in the Sacramento Bee with Steinberg's comments in it, fairly detailed, and I think he's hit the sweet spot. And seeing, he's talking about limiting it greatly, and not CEQA itself, but just the myriad of appeals to areas around transit. And it's going to be pretty defined. And I think it actually has a possibility of passing. And I, quite frankly, I support it with trepidation. Because I think it's basically a good idea when you're trying to do these equity-based things to have some limit to the more powerful and moneyed older forces in the community that don't want change.
All right, thank you. Kathleen?
I have a question on the VMT tax that we weren't clear about last time, and that there didn't – I'll put it as a question. So – there was not a different application of the VMT tax for low-income versus not low-income populations. Is that correct?
Correct. In the analysis, we charge it across the board.
I thought staff had some really creative approaches to the climate initiatives, particularly where it says car sharing. But one of my questions is, how do you envision that actually really just bringing forward or really growing? Are you looking more at public or private sector taking the initiative, or residents in the community taking the initiative? And how do you envision those incentives pretty much working for the public and the private sector?
I think you're asking about the specific car sharing project that's included in the plan. So the car sharing initiative focuses on investing sort of startup money, working with public and private organizations. That's one of the climate programs that, you know, as we develop the actual programs in detail, we'd be back to the commission and this group to talk through. But it mainly focuses on working with existing, like City Car Share and other organizations that are out there, and trying to see where and how they can effectively expand.
And when you're saying expanding, you're not expanding where those programs are occurring currently, as well as into areas where they're not at all occurring?
The proposed project in the plan includes both.
Okay.
And I think the question is timing and how and where and when. But that's the stuff that will get worked out as we move towards implementation.
Okay. Thank you. Other transportation? Comments? Yes.
Well, I think at some point we're going to get to this now that the executive director is in the room. We can bring up our perennial topic of of express lanes. And I think what's useful about this.
We waited just for you to get here, Steve.
Right, so you could. And I think, this is a very straightforward one in terms of what the alternatives are of what the options, at least as they're noted here. And I think it's an appropriate chance. This group has spent more time on hot lanes probably than any other single topic over the last couple of years. And so I would be curious to hear others if they had a strong reaction to what the alternatives are, just to sort of note them. One is sort of the plan, the express lane network, as MTC's proposed, some several hundred miles, and it's a mix of conversions and new carpool lanes that people can, single occupant vehicles can pay to go into. And then the two alternatives, it seemed, one is reduced express lanes in alternative three, and then the last one is without any of the expansions, which are kind of in a number of places in the region. So it seems like there is the opportunity for us to make a statement if we endorse one or more of those, since those were all tested as different alternatives. So I'm directly asking folks if people want to weigh.
Loris?
Yes, I have maybe a different opinion, having moved to Sonoma, that I know that in the best of all worlds, we'd like to have public transportation everywhere. And we'd like to have it to be efficient and get where we wanted to get when we wanted to get there. But let me give you an example of one that I think about. One area that I think about is Livermore. There is enough need to have an express lane. There's enough need to have public transportation. There's enough need for BART to expand to Livermore, in my opinion, right? Yet, when this came up and there was expansion to the Oakland Airport for BART, the BART board chose to expand when there is other options to get to the Oakland airport. So, as I listen, and living in Sonoma, and I frequently go down to the peninsula. Now, going where the express lanes have opened up, it's much easier to get down there now, and there's no way that I can get down there on public transportation. And there's no way that some of the people who go back and forth on a daily basis can get there. So I don't think that express lanes are a bad thing necessarily, and I don't think that in my lifetime there'll ever be a public transportation that's going to replace us riding in cars. I mean, there's not the political will for it in this country. So I guess I have maybe a little bit of a different opinion about not expanding.
Rich?
Not going to be an apples to apple comparison, but just because the density in LA is so much higher. But I just had an experience in LA that the 110 and the 10 are both HOT lanes in the commuter lanes solidly. It's now what I'm told, because I took transit It's $7 from Long Beach to downtown L.A., which has encouraged a lot of people, obviously from my trip on transit, to take the blue line because it runs every 6 minutes and it takes 50 minutes as opposed to 2.5 hours to get downtown. So in an instance where there is density, these lanes are paying for increased costs of highways, and they're also putting people on transit who are tired of sitting in traffic. And having said that, last time I saw any figures, L.A. only carries, their transit is packed, and it only carries 6% of the commuters because there's so many commuters. So, but think about what those freeways would be with an additional 6% on them if that did not exist. So I think both can be accomplished in the best of all worlds. That's what I'm saying.
Dolores and then Bennett.
Yeah, I just want to say one more thing. There's nothing in this country that has to do with transportation that there's a cost benefit that comes out on the plus side. I mean, you have your freeways are paid for by tax dollars. Your public transportation is all subsidized. Probably, I don't even know now, but it probably 80 or 90% of it is subsidized by the taxpayer. So so when you're looking at the cost benefit, there isn't such a thing that's going to come out on the plus side with anything. Streetlights are what, $250,000 a piece?
At a fire sale. Benna.
Lucky day. Okay. The leadership group supports express lanes. We see it really as utilizing excess capacity that already exists on our highways and being more efficient with it. But I think there is a question about the timing of express lanes region-wide and when certain lanes should be built and when we might want to wait until the congestion gets worse or the economic situation changes more. I know that 237, the express lane on 237 in Santa Clara County has been very successful. That's partially because congestion's terrible on 237. And there's other highways in the Bay Area that have less congestion, and maybe it makes sense to wait a little bit longer to build those. But I know those decisions will be made down the line by this new authority, BAFA, and others. So I think it's for a long-term plan, it's okay, and it's good to have all the possibilities in there for now, and then we're going to work on implementation later.
Linda, and then Randy.
I just wanted to make a comment on the transportation things. I think you really need to look at an area and decide what is the best method. Like, for instance, I will give you an example. There was a horrible accident on 580 the other day. I was in the middle of the highway when that happened, and it took me 2.5 hours to go 10 miles. The BART train could have gone right through. So there's a good reason to bring BART all the way out there. That's correct. It's going to exist, though.
I think this just brings up the deficiency in looking at an express lane as a standalone component of regional transportation, which is what we're doing, and we're not tying it into regional transit. So for me to get from here to my house, I could drive on express lanes half the way, but I can't take transit, and I certainly can't take transit around any of the other counties. So the original conversations that we had have somehow gotten lost, and I'd like to see us moving forward looking at how do we actually tie the transit into the express lanes, because this isn't all we're doing is creating a stopgap short-term system for making the traffic move faster on the freeways, but we're not creating any incentives or any program that gets people out of their damn cars. So, including me. So I'll be the first to say I'm guilty of it. I'm not going to spend 4 hours taking transit up here if I don't have to. But at the same time, I don't see this plan at this point tying into any of that. And that also becomes an equity issue for people who are of low income trying to take transportation and transit to medical appointments or work or school actually reaping any benefit from these the hot lane networks.
Kathleen.
Randy, that reminds me of something you mentioned in a last meeting, and I think it just bears repeating, is that as we look at the displacement risk associated with this and pushing people farther out, remembering that the plan is supposed to be reducing per capita VMT, and that as we displace people further out with even fewer transportation choices, that gets worse. So I know that's more of a policy direction conversation, but I thought it was worth repeating.
I just want to, Steve.
I got to get in. There is a lot of bus service on the HOV system today. AC Transit, VTA, Westcat, I mean, East South Bay, a lot of it. That bus service will benefit, in my opinion, greatly from the Express Lane network. Because, first of all, one thing that putting a toll on those lanes does is it allows you to keep traffic flowing. We have some HOV lanes now that are too successful. They're slowing down because they have so many carpools in them, even on 80, which is HOV3. So one thing tolling does is it allows you to give a good ride to anybody who's in that lane, including on a bus. And secondly, I think the pieces of the system where we're connecting HOV lanes that aren't there today by admittedly putting some new pavement down, that does benefit people who are carpooling. It benefits people who pay the toll. But it also benefits those buses now that have to get out of an HOV lane and slog through the traffic just like the carpools do and then look for the next HOV lane to pick up. So I do believe that HOT lanes are a multimodal solution, and they are a whole lot more cost-effective than rail transit in many cases. Now, this region is quite wealthy, and we've been able to afford a lot of rail transit investment, and I think that's to our ultimate benefit, because then you're on a completely separate guideway and you're good to go, and you can electrify the system. I mean, you can do a lot of things that I think benefit the environment and the whole mobility situation. But I think as a short-term strategy at fairly low cost, the notion of converting, and I think this is what we'll do first, getting back to that question of what comes first, we'll be converting the HOV lanes that exist. The HOV lanes that Caltrans put out there, they put them in places for a reason. That's where the congestion is. But they're not connected. So I think step two is to try to connect them. And I think there are some who think we should just stick with step one and stop there. And I think you do sacrifice quite a bit of system benefit by stopping before you connect. And then the third one, as I think Aegon mentions, are the set of extensions, I would call them, instead of connections, extensions out to the periphery of the region, whether out to the valley, the Central Valley in the east on 580, or out to the Sacramento Valley through 80. And I think there people also raise additional concerns about, are we really facilitating that movement when we really are trying to grow more inwardly in the Bay Area? So I do think that's a helpful way of looking at the lanes, and I think the further out you go, the more costly they are to build, for starters, which means we will probably get to them last, if at all. And they also tend to provide the least amount of benefit or revenue back into the system. So I think in closing for me, what's really and it's almost coincidental maybe, but the way the system will probably roll out is, I think, in a way that deals with the parts of the system that most people are okay with the most, you know, which is just converting the existing lanes, no new pavement, and to the extent you generate excess revenue, you have revenue for new transit service in those corridors. And that the system will almost naturally roll out in a way where it gets to the lanes that I think are most objectionable to most people last, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I think, Jim, are you trying to make a comment here? Steve, could you...
There you go. Yeah, I should know how to turn that on. I bring the... perspective of a blind person using transit for business purposes. You know, I've heard quite a bit on this council about people with disabilities using BART and transit for medical purposes, and I certainly understand that. And there are times when I have to do that too. But I am really in favor of converting the lanes to use for, for buses, for transit as much as possible, because I don't have the benefit of being able to drive cars like some of you do have. So, and I really identified when Rich was talking about being in Southern California, riding on that bus and being able to go from Long Beach to Los Angeles much more quickly than people who are in cars or sitting out there in traffic. And I'm glad I can't drive a car because it would drive me crazy. It really would. I mean, there's an impatient side to me when I want to get somewhere to a meeting, to an appointment, where money's an issue, you know. I mean, time and money is all important to me as an entrepreneur. I'd go crazy having to drive a car. So it's good for me to ride transit. So I'm a frequent rider of BART. Quite often I'll have to use buses in congested areas like in Oakland or in San Jose, and it just works really, really well. So I hope we can move in that direction even more.
Great. Maybe that's the next tagline or motto. I don't want to be driven crazy. I have Randy and then Rich and then Egon.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify my position on the HOT lanes in transit, and that is, and I'll use a friend of mine as an example. She lives here in Oakland. She works for Apple. She gets on an Apple bus and goes to Cupertino. If I work at the building next door to Apple in Cupertino and I live next door to her in Oakland, I don't get that benefit. So, and I would take, and actually she rides her bike, believe it or not, from Oakland to Cupertino periodically. So what I don't see is I see the private companies taking advantage of this, but I don't see us as a regional body saying, wow, we could actually somehow integrate a transit system so I'm not getting on a bus in Oakland and then switching and getting on BTA and then making another switch somewhere down the line. So that's my issue, is that the network of roads is one thing. The network of transit is a completely different issue. And going from Long Beach to LA is a really good example of that. That's a little bit farther, I think, than from here to Cupertino.
Absolutely. And I think I had Rich and then Lori.
Thank you very much. I support very much what Steve said. And I actually had that sort of in mind when I was making my comments. And I think when we just emphasize the inner city and transit for that, we fall in the dangerous position of making those people who are fearful of the change think that we're trying to force them into a lifestyle they don't want. And that's not what we're trying to do at all. One comment after agreeing is that I hope when we're doing these lanes, especially the new ones that we built, we do what I've seen in other places and actually used, is that they're actually express bus stops right on the freeway. And that's, I think, very important, the convenience of it. Yeah. And it may be difficult to do in existing freeways, but not impossible, but I think very easy to do when we add space. And I've seen it in more than one area, and I see people waiting at those buses all the time, waiting for those buses all the time. It does offer, especially when they're elevated, some barriers to people, I think, with disability, because I don't remember seeing any elevators with those. But that's also not impossible to do if you need to.
All right, Lori.
I want to say thank you to Steve, first of all, and then also Randy. I totally agree with what Randy said in terms of the connection and, for inner cities and outside of a municipality. And I'm back on the area of a city plan or like a general plan or a specific plan. And I just think that when you look at the circulation element of those plans, they should just be more in all throughout all communities. They should coordinate with what other communities are doing just to make sure that those circulation elements for connectivity, transit connectivity, makes sense. And that anything going outside of those communities onto the freeway, that they make sense. And then that kind of addresses Randy's question in terms of getting you to from point A to point B without having to make so many transfers. Because I know that in most communities where minorities reside, unless they have to get on public transit, they won't. For that very reason, because of having to transfer so many times, as opposed to just maybe getting into maybe a 1970-something, you know, and driving that, even if it needs smogging, they'll still drive it because it's easier to get there. So I just think that when you look at circulation elements or any type of circulation plan, any specific plan, it should really address connectivity. It should address ensuring that neighboring communities also have maybe that same approach to when you leave, let's say you leave Vallejo, you get through Vallejo to Oakland, that there is just a straight shot. And I know what you're saying about the express buses, but when you get off that express bus to really get to your point, you may have to take two other buses to get there. So thank you.
Great, thank you. And I think, Steve, I think you framed it well, and it sounds like people agree with your framing of conversions do first, connections do still, and extensions maybe don't do, but reconsider in the future. I know those weren't your words of maybe don't do, but sort of we can reconsider it. However, there are two things though that weren't addressed that I wanted to raise or ask about. One is the idea of converting mixed flow lanes. Right, that being something which is not you hear all the time, but in a sense, and we had this conversation I think when Randy was here, looking at if we're talking really about connecting places and connecting express lanes, there are places where those gaps, like the highway directly outside the building, a few blocks away, and so the express bus, if there is one on that route, gets stuck in the traffic with everyone else. So if the policy goal indeed is to make a connected network that works for carpools and for buses, then shouldn't we not be actually doing that across the region and thus looking into converting mixed flow lanes?
I don't think we have an objection to that on principle. I will say we do not have authority to do that. The authority we got from the State Transportation Commission did not extend to converting mixed flow lanes. And it actually goes back to when our current governor was governor the first time, and they tried it on the Santa Monica Freeway in Southern California, and I swear to God, everybody still remembers at Caltrans. You know, 40 years later, they are scared to death of the subject, which is why, basically, they won't do it, except maybe at gunpoint. Now, you know, we've done a couple of studies in the Bay Area, in San Mateo in particular, on converting mixed flow lanes to HOV or HOT lanes. And I have yet to see one that really pans out, you know, because generally it makes the congestion in the regular lanes worse. And that is, you know, fundamentally the concern I think that Caltrans has. But you're right. There are places like the Nimitz where you're really not going to do it any other way unless you come into, you know, $2 billion to do double-deck freeways or something like that. So, again, I don't think we've got an objection to it, but we've got, I think, a very hostile statutory framework to try to pull it off.
Maybe I could suggest, and I don't know if people are interested in converting to a motion, that's precisely the kind of thing that could go into the policy platform changes into the future.
That's correct.
So,
and look, I think ultimately, like a lot of things that you think you can never do, right? You know, we could never have national health care. We could never have this, that. We can never go to the moon, right? I mean, you figure it out eventually sometimes. And I think as congestion worsens on those regular lanes, then the trade-off maybe gets a little closer.
Right.
So maybe some kind of advocacy element here to give us some authority, if we can work up the courage, to try to do it.
Great. And then the other, just the two little things. One is the other piece we didn't talk about was, and I believe this was presented at some point, was looking at changing the number of people per vehicle that are required to be able to get into an HOV lane. And I believe MTC would have the authority to.
We do, and we are going to look at that. And most of the better analyses that you see, not only about mobility, but about revenue yield, are assuming that we convert a lot of these HOV2 lanes to HOT3. If you don't want to do that, you tend to have to, and I know VTA is considering this as an example, you tend to have to build two HOT lanes to handle all the HOV2s you have. If you're willing to bump it up to HOV3, which is primarily the approach that Texas has taken, you can accommodate quite a bit more capacity in the lane if you bump up the occupancy requirement to 3.
So maybe that would also go into the category of encouraging. Sounds like it's a piece of that, but it's not. It's in the study mode as opposed to a policy.
Well, and look, that's going to be one of the tougher, and we want you all involved in this as we go down the line. That's going to be one of the tougher calls, I think, for our commissioners to make, because it's tough to change the rules on people. You know, it's one thing if you open a new lane and it's HOV3 to start. Then it's that was the rule, and okay. But we got a lot of HOV2 out there, and converting them is going to be difficult.
So this probably doesn't fall under my comment right now, Steve, to you and to the staff will not fall under this Plan Bay Area, but Dolores or somebody, Linda, I think, brought up a comment about being stuck in traffic and going 2.5 hours and only driving 10 miles approximately. You know, throughout Southern California, there's signs on all their freeways, whether it's the 405 or the whatever the thes are. But whatever I drive on, it seems that there are signs constantly, and I mean constantly like every half mile, and I could be off there. But the signs state, if you get into an accident, move it off of the freeway. And I think there's one sign somewhere here in Northern California that I recall seeing, because I haven't been in Southern California for a number of years. But I would love to see that here. We get so much traffic tied up over a fender bender because they just sit there until a tow truck comes that they don't even need, or a CHP, etc. And I would love to see some program outlined where MTC really takes more of a stand-up position on this and works towards clearing our freeways once minor accidents occur. I can understand major accidents, and the CHP is out there measuring and all kinds of other things, but to me it would help flow no matter which lane you're in. So, side issue I've been wanting to bring up for nearly 3 years, and I thought before I leave here I probably should. So, okay, our next, one of our next topics. Yes, I'm sorry, yes, Gerald.
I've been there and done that, and it sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Yes, now we have a law that we can cite you for blocking the roadway on a property-only collision. You know, this isn't Perry Mason, don't move the body. When it is what it is.
Right.
But remember what our freeways look like. I mean, I got to L.A. in 1980, and there was no center divider on the Harbor Freeway. There was that railing. Then that construction started. And then they decided they needed sound walls. So then that construction started. Then they decided they needed another lane. And that construction started. Then they decided they needed bus ramps in the center divider. And there are elevators on the Imperial Highway. That wasn't even there when I got there. You know, and it all continually changes. How long do you want to live through that process when you live next door to it? You know, and at the end it was like, how much more land can we buy from side to side? You know, if we put another two lanes out here, how close will that freeway be to this building? And it's safety. You know, for us, yes. Santa Monica Freeway now has, and they have signs now down there that say, if you have an accident, pull over to the right if you can. If not, I remember one commissioner said, push it. I probably totaled your car out as I did it, but I cleared the roadway, making more people happy than the people at the accident scene. But, you know, things come and change. You know, we try to do the best we can, or they do. By the same thing, you know, my patrol car got hit every other year, whether I needed it or not, being out there. So if we can do change and improvements, great. But it's a land use issue. We can get wider or we can make longer trains, I think, to move. There's only so much space that we can work with. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich.
Just a comment. In the last about 5 years, most of the states have passed laws requiring you, when you see an emergency or an officer stopped near the shoulder, to pull to the left of that officer and pass in the other lane, or you can be cited. That's some more protection for the responders.
Great, thank you. Okay, Egon, you had one or two more points there?
Well, I think we're trying to close up the discussion on the transportation investments before we shift to maybe the equity analysis and some of the issues. And so I wanted to just ask a question about the VMT tax, kind of similar to the VMT fee on the land use side. Back to staff, what did you learn from that, and where do you see this going?
Well, a VMT charge, whether you call it a tax or a fee or whatever it is, could raise a considerable amount of money. It's probably, in my experience, one of the most unpopular ideas that we've ever introduced. And whenever we introduce it, there's always a lot of press attention. And I expect that when the commission debates this, there'll be more attention to it as well. I'm just not sure it has near-term political viability. We've modeled it. This must be the third or fourth plan where we've modeled some alternative that has some type of fee like that. But I think with the public, you still run into this very strong concern, first of all, that you're somehow taxing my mobility. And a lot of people think mobility is a good thing and that you should tax bad things. And secondly, the means of collecting the fee, if it involves tracking my movement, I don't like that either, right? I don't like Big Brother and government knowing what I'm doing. And I've been making the joke on this subject for some time, but it's a true thing that in Washington, Senator Boxer, who chairs the Environment and Public Works Committee, which does the highway bill, and her former ranking minority member, Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, are about as far apart as you can be politically, and they both hate this idea with a passion. So it unites right and left in terms of disliking it. So I just don't know how much viability it has in the near term. It's nice to talk about and study, but I just don't see the path to implementation.
Just as a quick follow-up, that I think the suggestion I would make to MTC is to try to get in front of this issue and frame it. And I think that maybe what happened a year ago is it got framed by the media as opposed to by those that think this is something that we might want to do. And so there are good answers to all the issues you raised, whether or not people are listening to those. But I think an argument could be made that if this is something that when you look at your financial projections for how the system is going to work over the next decade or two, I can't see it working without something like this. Whether or not it raises a lot of money, the other issues, it's not about new money, it's about replacing the gas tax and the fact that the federal government is going out of the transportation business. So it's sort of, like some of these other things, maybe it's inevitable, but the crisis gets worse each year that we allow it to be framed by others outside of it. So I'd say that this is something where, if there's a better alternative, great. There doesn't seem to be a better alternative, short of maybe tolling the highways, you know, you have to pay as you're kind of going through that way. But this is something where it's probably worth putting a little effort into if the alternatives like changing the federal gas tax are not going to be possible. And getting beyond the privacy issue, explaining to people that they do pay insurance and insurance companies know how much you drive and you have to do those estimates anyway. I mean, I think you're well aware of all the arguments and framing.
I am, and I've made many of them myself. I really think this is one of first impression, and I think you don't get to square two on this. I mean, remember Ray LaHood, the outgoing Secretary of Transportation. He mentioned one day in Washington, maybe we ought to study this. That's all he said. And that afternoon, the White House press secretary slapped him down and said, it will never be the policy of this administration to do this thing. I just think it's radioactive, to be blunt about it. And I just don't think there's a whole lot of education you could do to make it to decontaminate it.
Question, have we learned anything yet from Oregon? Because they are doing an experiment.
Well, they've done
this.
Quite a bit of work on it, and God bless Oregon. You know, maybe they can implement it. I don't see it here. I don't see it nationally. I think tolling, frankly, is more promising, an alternative.
Okay, I have Kathleen and then Randy.
This
and
is
then Naomi.
Kind of just an aside, but Egon kind of touched on it. Just in discussing the VMT tax loosely with an associate who's I don't remember their position within GEICO, brought up the insurance lobby and insurance industry as a potential ally in this, in streamlining the fact that they do already collect travel behavior data and kind of easing the framing and implementation using them as a partner. But that's just a
look. I hope to be proved wrong. Don't get me wrong. We certainly need some kind of long-term replacement to the gas tax, but maybe that's one trick we haven't pulled yet.
Great. Any other comments? Yeah, Alan.
I hate to beat a dead horse. I think I brought this up probably 2 months ago, and I still don't understand why this state is one of the few states in the union that doesn't have a fuel extraction tax. We're certainly not getting a deal on fuel.
Now, that's the one I like.
I really don't understand it. I don't think the people would be that far behind that eight ball, because it really doesn't cost us anything. They're charging it everywhere else. They pay a surplus in Alaska on it out to the citizens. They pay most of their taxes in Louisiana on it. And we as a state let the fuel companies, the oil companies, foreign companies, get away for free. And they're taking it out of our hides. And they're going to do the same thing when they start fracking in this state. There's so much energy that they pull out of the ground. We're talking about billions of dollars a year. And it disappears. And if anyone talks about it, of course, you have Chevron and all the guys putting up funds not to pass the tax. But we've got to get smart one of these days and get a tax that won't really cost us anything. We're talking about an international market that everyone else gets it. We don't. What's wrong with this picture? Anyway, I'm not running for office here.
it's a good thing you're not.
I think it was on the ballot, and the voters turned it down a couple of years ago.
There was $80 million on the other side.
Right. Randy.
I think it's a matter of framing it, because the single thread comes out, VMT tax or assessment or whatever we're going to call it. Rather than framing it as a larger conversation, and if you bring Alan's suggestion into the conversation and you bring other options into the conversation, VMT might not be the way to go. There might be other ways of doing it, and I think that that's, I would just simply caution that we don't stick with that sole thread at the risk of unraveling the entire garment. And I think if we phrase it in a manner of, we need to have this conversation because we need to be more independent with how we raise our funds to keep our roads going and show that we're not going to be getting the funds that we've had before, that we get a better conversation out of this and we keep some of the craziness out of the conversation. And we, quite honestly, we bring in both sides of the picture at that point. We bring in the far left and we bring in the far right.
You know, Madam Chair, I do have to leave and go deal with bolts, and I thank all of you for not asking me about bolts at all. But just one thought on the general subject of revenue. As you know, in this plan, we make a big deal about self-help, and we are helping ourselves to a very considerable extent. And we think that probably is the most promising thing to do in the future, because where so many of these ideas fall a cropper, whether it's VMT taxes or extraction taxes, is they get caught up in the money game in Sacramento and Washington. And, you know, special interests just have a way of swatting these things down. So to the extent we can get empowered, either with a lower vote standard or a broader array of tools that we can try in the Bay Area, because I think in many respects we are often more willing to be experimental than maybe somewhere else in California or somewhere else in the United States. I think that really is the key. The more authority we can get in our hands, I think the more our fate is in our hands, and we're less reliant on politics working better in state capitals.
Great. Thanks, Steve. I have
Naomi.
I'll leave
you with that thought.
I'm glad you raised Bolts, though, because I was going to bring up Willie Brown's article. Have a good afternoon. Naomi, the floor is yours.
Okay. I actually didn't have a comment about VMT. I was trying to branch over to equity. I had the benefit of going to the ABAG General Assembly along with some other members of this committee as a guest of the MTC just recently, and one of the speakers was a professor from UC Davis who was talking about development in certain communities and development by transit, and he had a really great emphasis on focusing on ethnic communities and local communities and communicating with them in the way so that the development that was being designed and planned was actually what they wanted and could use. And I just wanted to throw that out there as a reminder, as we're working on these PDAs and this development, to really make sure that these developments have a cultural relevance for the people that we want to live there. So, just a general comment.
Other comments on the equity aspect of this conversation? Okay. Any questions you have of us on the equity aspect? From the staff's point of view, is there something we need to be maybe further discussing or exploring?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, as someone who's spent a lot of time with a number of you in the equity working group, I think we have a pretty firm handle that the biggest issues, at least, that we've been really talking about are affordability of housing and, to a lesser extent, but also important, transportation. And obviously also we've spent a lot of time talking about the issues and the concerns around displacement. I will say that, you know, Jennifer is working on kind of finalizing that report. You know, I think one of the things that's important to note, and I think we see this just even in this conversation here, how it's so easy to start straying from what the purpose, you know, of this plan is, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a great platform in this plan to say, really talk about economic development in, you know, some of our most depressed communities of concern, or a great way to deal with the fact that we have a rapidly increasing change in the migration patterns of immigrants to this country, you know, bypassing cities, heading straight into the suburbs, you know. And so I think there's things like that that we want to try and flag kind of with, you know, with you and with our partners, but also recognize that some of our tools and some of our activities are going to be pretty constrained in those regards because they fall pretty far beyond, you know, our core purpose.
And I do think that policy-wise we do need to look, especially since we're looking at the PDAs, because economically what happens is if you build around transit, you increase the property values. So the tendency is to build market rate housing and say, oh, the low-income housing will come along behind it. And what winds up happening is that pebble dropped in the water. You just get farther and farther out into the rings and the ripples before you actually start building. So I would really like our PDAs going forward to have an emphasis from an equity perspective of providing the infrastructure for low-income housing adjacent to transit. And I will bring up the TOA funds is an example where I don't think we looked at that quite properly because a project that was funded for senior housing for seniors without vehicles was touted as being adjacent to transit because a light rail line went by it across the street, but the light rail stop is a half a mile away. So I deal with seniors on a daily basis, and there's no way I'm walking any of my seniors half a mile down Southwest Expressway to get to that particular light rail stop. So I just want to make sure that going forward our programs, because we're going to come up in the next 28 years with more innovative things, that we actually look at a nexus relationship for transit, true transit, because that also flows into our paratransit dynamic when we look at these programs. instead of just saying, oh, it's relatively close.
All right. Any other comments on the equity issue? All right. Then let us talk about public participation. Where do we go from here?
I think the one thing that I know our particular public participation staff are interested in on is just if there is feedback in terms of, you know, how it went or how it could be more effective. So if there's any key things that you've talked about as a group that you'd want to report back to the commission, that just might be something for you to consider.
Anything on that topic, Kathleen?
Sorry to harp on this, but I really, in the development of the PDA growth and investment strategies, I realized the CMAs were given guidance. How I've seen stakeholder engagement and public participation in that process in my county has been to the advisory groups within the congestion management agency and the meeting of the planning directors. That's not in line with the guidance that was provided by MTC. So I think as far as the growth and investment strategy being kind of a potential Achilles heel for ensuring equity and how this is rolled out, I think without waiting until the first review of these growth and investment strategies, we can already say that it's not being carried out to the spirit of the equity that that was defined at this group and defined by the commission. So insofar as, you know, I know MTC doesn't have local land use jurisdiction, but they do have control over some of the funds that are flowing through that. So I would really encourage strong guidance about how those are developed, how the public is engaged in those, in the development of those, because that's the public's real opportunity to say, you know, I want my congestion management agency to be very proactive in providing examples of affordable housing policies or protection of existing stock. And if we can't still maintain some encouragement of public participation and equity at that level, there's going to be a gap. We're going to miss an opportunity there. So I think that's a critical equity.
So, Randy?
Just on the communication level, while it's really good to say that the communities self-nominated themselves for PDAs, that self-nomination didn't necessarily come with any outreach to the community. It came through, in general, and using my city as my only true example, general plan meetings, which went on for, I think, 4 years. And at no point was my community advised of our urban village that was plopped down in my neighborhood. So just as an example, what happens is it's an after the fact, oh, now we're going to bring the community into it after we've zoned it and after we've declared it a PDA. And at no point do I see, I'm holding meetings without my transit people there, which seems to me really kind of dumb, because the questions are being asked, how do we actually get people on transit from these particular areas? So I would like to see some consistency in how we outline public outreach going forward for our programs, that communities can't just hold a meeting with the planning director or planning staff and the transit agency, that somehow you have to show that there was a community meeting involved and that the community received appropriate outreach, not we published it in the little two-page paper that legal notices go in. Simply for consistency's sake, and quite honestly, because I'll stand there and say I'm your rep at MTC meetings, and then they yell at me because the outreach wasn't done right, and they think it's an MTC project. So to keep the crazies from showing up on your doorstep, let's just look at proactively designing how we want outreach to look, because the communities that are impacted are quite often the low-income minority communities that have the most to lose and the least amount of input when things happen.
Will?
Along the same lines, you know, dealing with immigrant communities saying that are monolingual, we have a hard time explaining to them all those acronyms. And it could take us an entire evening just to go through the acronyms and then try to present the picture that you're trying to show us is another challenge. You know, we spend a lot of time, and there's a lot missing in terms of saying, well, you have a reference book of all these terms, but to them, it doesn't mean anything until you could tie it to a project that's going to affect them. And that's the hard key, is to say, okay, how do we explain it to them, what the impacts are, you know, what's the cost going to be, and what do you prefer? It needs to be, you know, phrasing the question, do you want this or that, so that they can understand something, rather than just throw out a lot of things out to them, and they'll look at you with a quizzical look that says, I don't know what you're saying, really, on it. So I do spend a lot of time trying to explain transportation plans and, you know, community plans, so that it could be, we try to make it understood, but we're nowhere as near where it should be. I've been working with the community for, you know, the last 30 years, and it's still the same thing. Every two decades, we have a new wave of immigrants that we have to start all over with. Again, we still don't have that reference book that explains it in layman's terms. Thank you, anyways.
Rich?
Now, I'd like to actually tout my city's outreach on these areas. Long before PDAs were put into law, thanks to the leadership of Sue Limpert, who was on this commission for many years, we had a corridor plan that went through several phases. And at each phase, people not just from the usual suspects, but from people from neighborhoods, because we are a city of neighborhood associations, were put up by their neighborhood associations to serve on it. We had a tremendous amount of people commenting at the meetings. In other phases of it, the man to the left of me here went out into the community itself for his own development. Actually, I think you're in a partnership with MTC for about $600,000 for bike lanes, right? And so I think we did it right. I'm sure you can find objections to the entire process. The people that were on the side that didn't stop the changes would feel like there wasn't enough outreach because not enough of their people showed up. But they were pretty good at getting people out, so I'm not sure that's true. So I think that there is a way to do it right, and I think there are models around there. And maybe I'm just too chauvinistic about ours, but I really liked it. I thought it worked.
Just to clarify, Rich, it's the city of San Mateo I'm partners with. They're getting their money from
MTC.
MTC.
Yeah.
So maybe... So, Carolyn and Doug, maybe one way to figure out how to better the process is for you guys to develop some type of short answer survey, not a rate at 1 to 5 or a yes or no, but, you know, kind of explain how did you do outreach in your communities. And then mass the names over, et cetera, bring them all, photocopy them all, and bring them back to this committee as one of our items of discussion, and let us kind of figure out, well, this kind of worked, or this sounds like it works, or because if something happens in one community and the other community doesn't even know that, you know, oh, what a great thought process. It just might be helpful for this committee to see and evaluate what they think are the best strategies given what's been done. Carlos?
Excuse me, I'll try to help with that. I think I might have a book from the ULI that talks about that.
Thank you.
He's good at it.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to make the community meetings for this process, so I don't exactly know how they were attended. I mean, I'm hearing anecdotally, you know, that some people come and they come with their own agendas, or they don't quite get what's being asked of them, and so they come with what's on their mind, and. So I guess I was thinking about it again through another process that MTC went through a few years ago, and I don't think it was ever complete. Maybe I'm wrong, but MTC was received funding to do all these community-based transportation plans throughout certain communities, and you know, I don't know if the last ones were ever done because it just stretched out over so many years, but I mean, it's going to be after the fact, but now you're going to have Plan Bay Area, and you have these PDAs. I'm thinking they seem, those kind of interactions with the community seem to be more fruitful when you're like, okay, we've got, I mean, it won't help you with the EIR because you'll hopefully have picked one alternative, but you know, so you'll say there's a menu of things that can happen here, and you know what's best, what's happening well here, and you know what's not working here. And at least you're framing, you're not giving it like, hey, what do you want, what do you think we should do, but you're kind of already starting to kind of create a little bit of boundaries of, you know, parameters to talk about. And like I said, those seemed pretty informative. I did sit in on one of those community-based transportation plans when it was being formed. And I don't know if that's something that could be done in the next few years, hopefully not stretched out over many years, but something like that as a follow-up to the Plan Bay Area.
Carlos, just one. I appreciate that. You know, I think that's actually one of our better programs, alongside, you know, not unlike our planning grant program, which, again, I think is trying to resource up folks to do a meaningfully, you know, engaged process. You'll be glad to know there's only about a half dozen left, but there's still a half dozen left. I mean, you know, 10 years in the making of the communities of concern, designation. So They've gone a long ways. I actually think, though, that if you look at some of the evaluations that we've done, you know, I think they've been very instrumental in projects getting funded, you know, both here and at the county and at the city level. And a number of a couple of CMAs took out money in the last round of Lifeline funding to actually update some of their community-based transportation plans, which we also see as a really good sign of the importance of that framework. So, you know, I think that there's still some programs like that that honestly need some care and feeding. They aren't maybe the flashiest and most exciting things that we do here, but I think in terms of, you know, impacting people in the community, they can be really a really important platform, and making sure that there's folks, you know, like you all, that if you think that's important feedback for us to get, because I can tell you not a lot of people ask us about the CBTPs anymore, but the folks that, you know, live in those communities are benefiting from the fact that in many, not always, but in many cases benefited from the fact that that planning work has gone on.
Great, thank you. The last item on our kind of structured discussion is the policy tools, and I don't know if there's anything specific we want to talk about. It looks like yes on Benna. Aegon shifted his weight, so that must mean yes.
I was looking at my head.
But why don't we wrap this up? Because we have a couple other items, and although, as I said earlier, the bulk of our discussion is on this, and I think it's been good discussion. So, Benna.
So just quickly, a couple of items that come top to my mind. First is lowering the vote threshold for transportation projects. Huge, huge, huge priority. We've had some heartbreakers in the region recently around sales taxes, just awful. So 55%, great, 50% even better. One step at a time. And then, of course, redevelopment 2.0, I think it captures a little bit what Carlos was saying before around value capture mechanisms. But there just has to be some sort of urban renewal and urban investment financing mechanism for the region. So we need to find a replacement. Of course, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention CEQA, CEQA modernization. And really, again, it's not to derail any of the great environmental aspects that are in CEQA right now, but it's to shift the focus back again to environmentalism and not get sidetracked with some of the other things that CEQA has been used for. So those are the three top ones that come to my mind. Thanks.
Thank you. I was actually shifting because I thought we'd done a lot of the policy discussion already. Although, sort of, one thing I wanted to note was in our discussion before, we'd had a kind of suggestion, or we talked a little bit around encouraging MTC to go to the state to try to push for the ability to convert mixed flow lanes to HOV lanes. That Steve had mentioned that's not currently, so that's something we could potentially add. The other thing, in the platform, it talks about, quote, defiscalizing land use decision-making. I can't remember the actual text of how close it gets, but I don't think it actually gets to what that really means, which would be sales tax sharing. right, that actually sharing a portion of the sales tax between neighboring jurisdictions across some geography, probably starting at a county or a sub-regional level. So this is I wanted to note it. It's something I'm very supportive of exploring. It's certainly been tried in California and was also pushed down. But I don't know if staff want to say anything more about the intention of including that and kind of where it goes from here.
Well, it is a draft plan. So it's a draft recommendation. I think in general, Egon, you know, you're correct. Obviously, sales tax has obviously been a huge driver of land use. I would say employment has also been a huge driver of land use. And in part, that's also been extremely driven by the fact that Prop 13 for so long has held, you know, property taxes below rates of inflation. You know, we weren't being overly specific, which, of course, can also be problematic. But I think there is this, you know, kind of family of fiscal issues that are going on out there in the world, and they're having massive implications for our transportation system, but also for how we develop. And, you know, I think listening to the discussions around things like affordability, you know, this is another one of the things that really gets just kind of caught in the crossfire on the fiscal issues. So, you know, I don't think we're coming out of this with a specific I don't think we're coming out of this plan without a specific agenda in mind on that issue. However, I think we would certainly welcome feedback, you know, and or direction for folks that think this is important.
You know, I live in a city that actually is the retail mecca in Central Peninsula, and I'm very much for reducing the fiscalization of land use. An example that I see happening right now of how this can really kill what we're trying to do, we specifically, with the city's blessing, zoned out of our PDAs, what are now PDAs within our corridor plan, big box stores, because of the dilatory effect it has on trying to move people by foot and by bicycle and other ways. Right now there's a proposal bring a Super Target into the Sears store at Hillsdale, which is right across the street from our PDA. And there is no, oh yeah, it's going to really, because if you bring food into a store, I have to go back and review it, but I've done a lot of traffic study analysis, and I think it's something like when you put a full-service food store in a big box store, it's a multiplier of about three times the traffic that a general merchandise store brings. So it will, and it's right across the street from a Caltrain station. So it's going to be a mess, especially since there's no grade separation there for that 31st Street. So that's one of the things that draws people to do this, is this fiscalization of land use and taxation. And the sharing of that actually gets other communities, because we've had other communities get involved in our development in a negative way, if they share the resources of that, helps bring them on board. I think it's a great idea.
Well, I think it's maybe when we look at fiscalization of land use, we're really talking about the preponderance towards retail versus other land uses. Mm-hmm. That housing is always seen as a loser revenue-wise for a city.
Exactly.
Because you have to provide all the services, and they don't pay per Prop 13 their way. So, you know, from that angle, if retail can be de-emphasized, that would be positive. I think the sharing of a sales tax issue is very revolutionary and interesting. I think we recently had a discussion at our housing committee of our members where one of them brought up the sharing of revenue for affordable housing. One day when redevelopment 2.0 comes back, whenever that will be, it might make sense to have a regional pot of money at the county level between three cities, whatever it is, that would rotate, and so you could gather money more quickly and have more of an impact. So, you know, I think there's promise in those kinds of ideas. But again, for fiscalization of land use, really centers around the retail versus other uses, in my mind.
Speak up.
All right. Carolyn and Doug, we need to kind of wrap up here. Let me ask you, have you heard enough concrete conversation here to go forward? Do you want this all wrapped up in a tidy little motion, which would be challenging at this point. But tell me.
I mean, I do think there are going to be a couple of different, you know, points in the process for you to advise the commission. I know typically you give your report to the commission. I mean, one also thought is, given so many of these discussions are going to be happening at the joint planning and ABAC admin meetings, if it might make sense for you to also, you know, give some policy advisory input at those meetings, just because at the commission it obviously doesn't, all of the decision makers on the plan votes don't always hear it. So that's something maybe Pam we can talk about a little bit. But I do think that if you as a group can sort of focus what your primary points are, you know, maybe using the structure of the land use transportation policies, it would be really helpful for the commission to hear a couple of bullets maybe under each of the major things that they'd like to see us focus on, thinking about implementation, or in terms of, you know, as the commission and ABAG finalize what the plan will be, what things, you know, what pieces of different alternatives you thought were most important to have them consider during this final policy trade-off discussion would be really helpful.
And I would just add that your next meeting is 2 days before that joint planning and admin committee. Okay. So if you have right now, let's say, a rather lengthy menu of comments, I mean, I think it's unclear if, you know, if one, it, does everybody in the room support every comment that was made? Perhaps not. You know, it seems like you might want to get to a more refined set of comments that have a broader, you know, and maybe clearer support. And I don't suggest trying to do that now necessarily,
right,
but just something to be cognizant of, that you have an opportunity, I think, at your next meeting where you could try to get to a much finer point and a much higher kind of level of priority relative to what you want to convey along.
Okay, great. Thank you. Rich?
Suggestion that you appoint an executive committee, possibly with yourself and Egon as chairing it, to go through the minutes and comments of this meeting and come to the next meeting with a prepared, that can be amended by people,
right,
a prepared proposal for an amendment.
Alan?
I think that's a great idea. I was going to suggest that you send it out before the meeting, and maybe we send comments back, and everyone takes some responsibility for areas that they feel strongly about, to not just make it all you guys,
right,
but to send comments back, and to have, because I do that on the technical analysis panel committee, where we use email to go back and forth, and by the time we sit down on a panel, we pretty much know where we're going.
Great. Pam, can we do that?
We just need to be very careful about doing that.
And the reason why I'm asking, I just don't know if people heard that,
yeah,
but because we're a public body and there's some Brown Act issues that could come up. And so
I was suggesting that you in fact notice it.
Yeah,
I mean, you could do it in one meeting.
I think the idea of the appointing a subcommittee to come up with some proposals with a proposal
do.
Is fine. I think it's the email commenting,
yeah,
back and
that.
Forth that is okay, a bit of a slippery slope that you,
yeah,
might not want to go,
right,
down.
So I think we could create a subcommittee. They can create the document. We can have that as part of our agenda items for the next meeting. And then we come to the meeting and respond to that document, I think, is probably how we do that.
There you go.
We just can't take the back and forth. Kind of the
right,
yeah,
right. It's just, it's, yeah. We want to stay legal. So.
And stay out of jail.
Who would volunteer to be on this subcommittee that I'll form?
I would, but I'm going to be out of town.
We'll have one.
No, I'm
not rich.
Well, you'll have as many meetings as, hopefully, one. Let's say the goal is one.
And
is that Kathleen?
When would that meeting be?
That will be determined by the people who will be on it,
yeah,
given their particular schedules.
Does this have to be noticed?
Right, and it could be it could be verbal. I mean, here's what I'm thinking: is Pam and I and Egon maybe flesh out the comments that Layla and Pam have taken down, and then give that to the committee to work on, and then have them work
That's
from
legal.
There.
That's very legal, yeah.
So, who?
So I heard Kathleen.
I heard Kathleen and Alan.
Well, I would, but I'm gone from the 20th probably to the 2nd.
Oh. Yeah. And we meet on the 10th?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to wiggle
That's
out of
tough.
It, but I'm going to be in San Diego next week, and the following week I'm going to be in Kansas City for 2 weeks.
Okay, so Carlos? You're looking at a calendar? We all have stuff. Let me just say it, right? I'm about to give some final exams, so.
I'll volunteer.
Richard?
I can be part of it, yes.
Carlos?
Yeah.
I should have
Marshall?
I'd love to get it.
Sure. That's good.
Can you chair it?
Be in Canada.
Sure, let's just talk.
Okay. All right, I think we have it. Aegon, Marshall, Kathleen, Richard, and Carlos.
And I just have a question for staff, which is public comments are due May 16th. So how does the Policy Advisory Council, in a sense, get a, because we're formally a part of the system, we're not subject to that?
Okay. Correct, yeah. Since you're advisory to the commission, you can comment whenever you feel like commenting.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Very good. We'll flesh that out then before we... Okay, thank you. Yes.
How soon can we have the minutes of this meeting to form a working basis?
As soon as I can get them done. I don't know.
We don't even...
You certainly can listen to the recording.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Would you say a week?
We will shoot for a week. We usually shoot for a week, and we're usually off by a week. So we'll shoot for a week.
Okay. Good. Alrighty. Alright, our next item on the agenda, the staff liaison report, which was all in your packet.
Yes, I can just quickly remind you that if you haven't gotten your application in for the next 4-year term for this council, please do so by Friday. Bike to Work Day is tomorrow, if you feel like biking. And then to Carolyn's point about the comment period closing on May 16th at 4 p.m., you hopefully all got the email that I sent you about the open town hall still being online. And so we would encourage whoever you know to go online and put in some comments on that forum.
All right.
And that's all I have.
All right. Any council member?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot one more thing. Our annual report, right. For those of you who have finished all of the Plan Bay Area booklets and are looking for some light reading, our annual report is out, and we did have some copies over here at the table if you want to take one, but it's also online if you'd rather be a little more green about it, but it is out thanks to our wonderful PI staff, so it's available for you.
Great. And any council member reports? Will?
Yeah, I attended the Plan Bay Area in San Francisco, and there was quite a few people, over 100 people attended. And it appears that in going through the Plan Bay Area, it was brought up that for housing displacement, there's no mitigation process identified. And that was reiterated by a number of people. So I just wanted to reflect that this is what a major comment was for the Plan Bay Area in San Francisco.
Hmm. Okay. Richard.
Yeah, and then I also attended the one for Solana County at the Solana County Fairgrounds, and there were a few dozen people there, and I think getting back to what we were talking about earlier about public participation and the public appears to be, not necessarily informed on all the they have a bad perception of the Plan Bay Area process, and and they're asking questions that should have been answered a long time ago and or whatever. So I think there needs to be more, as we get past this Plan Bay Area and go into the next phase, I think there needs to be a better process as far as educating the public and distilling the fear factor and so on.
Okay. Alan? No.
Is my light on?
Yes. All right. Any new business? Okay, seeing none, I adjourn this meeting at 3:41. Thank you.